Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Today is part 6 of the story of Stephen Lawrence. Arrested, tried and convicted for the murder of his father Willard Lawrence in 1992 after a house fire which police, with the aid of a private investigator hired by Steve's brother, would say he purposely lit. It's a crime he's always maintained he's innocent of. So after weeks of phone issues within Steve's facility, he finally managed to get back on the phone so that we could continue speaking about his trial.
Three-way calls are strictly prohibited in the violation of MDOC policy.
Thank you for using GTL.
Holy moly.
There he is. We did it.
Finally.
Oh, I tell you what, that was a nightmare, wasn't it, Steve? So after so many episodes and a lot of names and information that's been flying around, I was a little worried that we might be getting lost. So in our OMR Facebook group, I chucked up a poll asking the jury the question, do we need a recap? And the jury has spoken. So I'm going to give you a recap of where we are so far. Now, I understand that not everyone will need this recap, and if you'd rather not listen to me jibber-jabber for the next couple of minutes, you can skip forward to 15 minutes and 10 seconds exactly. There's a lot to cover. On the day of the fire that would take the life of Willard Lawrence, he was flying back into town. He was returning to Michigan from Florida for some doctor's appointments that he'd scheduled. Steve's brother, Don, would claim that another reason for Willard's visit home was to sit down with Steve to have a stern talk with him about his finances and to express his frustration with always having to bail Steve out of his money issues. He would be returning with $20,000 to help Steve pay off a credit card debt. Steve says there were no issues with his father. This was all untrue. His father was a very generous man and often gifted his kids money on a regular basis. In fact, during the trial that would follow the fire, Don, Steve's older brother, would be asked about money that he had been gifted by his father. And in 1 year, it would all add up to around $60,000 in different financial gifts in order to help Don out. And this was very similar with all of Willard's children. So on the day that Willard returned home, Steve says his brother Don calls him to say that he would in fact be picking their father up from the airport. Steve says that this was highly unusual. He always picked up their father due to the fact that his workplace overlooked the private airfield in which Willard's plane would arrive. Nonetheless, he agrees and Don would be the one to collect their father. Steve says late that afternoon, his wife Candy and their boys would go next door to Willard's home. Of course, the two families lived right next door to each other. They would turn some lights on and switch the heating on in preparation for his return home. We then know that later on that afternoon, Don would arrive at the home. He was going to pick up his father's car. He goes into the property and Steve says that he turns lights off, and for some reason goes to the back of the property, which overlooked the lake, and then comes back into the property. And on his way out, would switch off the home's state-of-the-art burglar alarm and fire alarm system. Something that was never done. Don would not make mention at trial anything about switching any lights off or exiting the property. In fact, he talks about the fact that he was just there to get keys. He didn't even take any notice of whether or not the heating was on or lights were on or anything. He just goes into the property, gets the keys, and leaves. However, he does testify to the fact that he did switch off the home's alarm system. He says it was in order to make things easier and more convenient for his father when he returns home. He then leaves with his father's car. Now, as a reminder, there had been a number of house fires that had been occurring in the Gun Lake area for some time prior to this fire occurring at Willard's home. However, no one had been arrested for these fires at the time. Steve says some paperwork does show the police did have a suspect at one stage who was known to his brother Don. However, no charges were ever brought. Don testifies that he and his father go out to dinner that evening. He would then drive him back to his vehicle, and that is the last he sees of his father. Later that evening, while asleep, Steve and Candy are abruptly woken by a loud bang. The window in their room is broken. This is another subject of conjecture during the trial, which we will talk to Steve about soon. Steve jumps out of bed and sees his father's home is on fire. He says he dials 911 and then would call his brother Don's home. Don is already awake. At Steve's trial, he says it's because the dog had been repeatedly waking him up that evening. However, at Candy's future trial, he would apparently say it was because he was watching a basketball game, which Steve says was proven to be untrue because there was no game on that evening. Claims would be made that Steve had called Don before attempting to call 911. However, again, this was proven not to be true because Don would testify that on his way to his father's house, he would meet the first fire truck that was going to the fire and follow it in. Because of the distance from Don's home to his father's house, if he had in fact been called first, he would have been there long before the first fire truck had arrived. Steve goes on to wake up his neighbours, Kay Simpson and her husband, to alert them to the fire. Kay would testify that she'd noticed, oddly, Steve and his son seemed to be dressed in full winter clothing, including jackets and boots, possibly alluding to the fact that they didn't look like people who had been startled awake and rushed out to a fire. She would then go on to testify that they get a ladder and placed it at a window. She goes up there to break the window. She says she later discovers it was not Steve's dad's bedroom, as she initially thought it was. Steve says the reason for this was due to the ledge that was at that particular window. He says his father was in his 70s and he believed it would be far easier to get him out this window due to the fact of having this ledge there. The door to this room that they were trying to get into was just inches away from his father's bedroom. He also says that Kay Simpson was well aware of which room was his father's bedroom. She had been a neighbour of theirs for many years and knew his parents very well. When we spoke about why Kay Simpson may have said certain things, Steve said he's not sure, but what he does know is that many meetings were had at Kay Simpson's home with private investigator Jerry Mattioli and other witnesses who would testify on behalf of the prosecution. While the commotion of the evening continues, Steve is now down at the lake with another neighbour and the both are struggling with a pump and a hose to try and get some water on the property. While down at the lake, the first fire crews arrive, as does brother Don. Private investigator Jerry Mattioli, who was hired by Don days after this fire had occurred, would make suggestions again that Steve would point firefighters to an incorrect window. However, during trial, Steve's brother Don testifies that a firefighter asks him which room is his father's, and he says he believes he tells them the top corner. Two other homes would be set alight that evening on Gun Lake. The prosecution and police would later surmise they believed that Steve most likely had also lit those fires in an attempt to divert attention. And no, there was no evidence to back up that assumption. The fire would eventually be brought under control in the early hours of the morning, and sadly, Willard Lawrence is found deceased and is removed from the property. Not long after the fire is reduced to embers, Don Lawrence would testify that amidst all the trauma, he realises there is a family they will need to put back together, and a family trust that will need to be run, which in turn makes him think that they need to make sure they have important papers that he knew was in his father's safe. He would ask the firefighters if they had located it, and they had. They bring it out and open it for him. Steve says he witnessed all of this happening from his home and says his brother Don was filling up bags with whatever paperwork was in that safe. Brother Don would testify that present for that, he believes, was a detective, his brother Dick, and Steve. However, again, Steve disputes this. Just a couple of days after the fire is when Steve's brother Don hires private investigator Jerry Mattioli. His apparent job is to investigate the fire and to get to the bottom of who lit this fire. Steve says from day one, this apparent investigation was solely focused on him. Steve and his family would decide to get away for a couple of days after this fire, as they didn't want to sleep in their home after what had happened next door. Not only because his father had just been killed next door, but also they were still concerned that someone may be out there and could come back and do the same to their property. PI Jerry Mattioli would state that Steve just disappeared and told no one where he was going. Steve says again, this is just not true, and he was in contact on several occasions during the time they were away. During his apparent investigation of this fire, Jerry Mattioli would speak to Steve on several occasions, on many occasions telling him that the police investigation was pointing more and more towards him as the culprit. Meanwhile, Steve says the police did not in fact have any suspicions about him at all and would testify to that fact and were getting all their information from Mr. Mattioli. One day, Steve would be summoned to his brother's home. He would walk in to see his brother Don sitting down in his office, flanked by two guys with guns on their hips. He says it was highly reminiscent of something out of The Godfather, and at this meeting, his brother would tell him that they are done. And not long after this, Jerry Mattioli would drive Steve to an attorney's, saying he's going to need one. Steve subsequently hires this attorney, and not long after, he is arrested. Steve's wife Candy is also arrested for Willard's murder, and both are sent to jail. Eventually, her charges would be downgraded to accessory instead of first-degree murder, and her mother would raise enough money so she would be released on bond. Upon release, she would go to pick up her sons, who had been staying with Brother Don. At this stage, the preliminary hearings had not happened, so Steve was unaware of the true extent of what his brother was going to put on him. So he was fine with his kids going to their uncle's. However, they would find out from the boys that Don and Jerry Mattioli would keep them up very late at night and essentially interrogate them about their parents, telling them they were murderers. During Steve's trial, his brother would be a key witness, as of course would Jerry Mattioli, and they would point out many things they say were suspicious about Steve. Don, of course, speaks about his brother's strained relationship with their father, the anger over Steve's money wastage, and the fact that this trip was as much to do with Steve's credit card debt and spending as it was to do with the doctor's visits. Brother Don speaks about a supposed argument between Steve, Candy, and his father, and how they had suggested, if he wasn't careful, they would sell their home to some less than desirable neighbours. Steve says again, this is all just utter fabrication and not true at all. He says his brother Don was jealous of the relationship that he had with their father, as well as how much his father doted over Steve's sons, as Don would never have children himself. One of the so-called pieces of evidence that was brought to trial was a gas mask. Steve says that at the time of the fire, he had in fact attempted to gain access to the home wearing a gas mask that a friend had in fact given them because of all these fires that were happening on Gun Lake. When Steve attempted to gain access to the home, he was overcome by smoke and the gas mask was essentially useless. He threw the gas mask down outside the property and that was the last he saw of it. Jerry Mattioli and Steve's brother Don would testify that they just happened upon this gas mask sometime after the fire. They were in Willard's barn where he kept a truck and a few other items and say it was just sitting right under one of the truck tyres. Don would testify that the truck had in fact moved in and out of that barn several times after the fire, and he'd never seen it there before. But here it was, in plain sight. He says he gives it to Jerry and assumes that Mr. Mattioli then took it to police. At trial, two experts would get up. The prosecution's expert would say that when the filter was tested, there was no sign of any smoke, which they would expect to see had someone tried to use it during a fire. However, there were trace elements of accelerant, like fuel, potentially suggesting that someone who may have been pouring fuel could have been wearing it. The expert for the defence essentially disagrees with the prosecution's expert. And so, we are up to date on the key information thus far.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Many claims, as we know, were made about Steve during his trial, and this was printed throughout the media. In fact, a newspaper, the Local Enquirer, posted an article Friday, May 1st, 1992, titled "Suspect Knew Too Much." The article reads as follows. Stephen Lawrence told at least one neighbour details only arson investigators knew about the fire that killed his father, according to testimony at a preliminary examination on Thursday. Arson investigator Rick Kemsky of the Michigan State Police described a pattern of burning in the home which indicated accelerant was poured throughout. Kemsky said Stephen Lawrence approached him several times during the investigation, but he didn't speak to Stephen Lawrence about burn patterns and told no one about how much accelerant he thought was used. Kemsky also said Stephen Lawrence showed him a Molotov cocktail he said he found outside his bedroom window. A neighbour, Kay Simpson, said Stephen Lawrence seemed to be anxious to tell me a lot of things about the fire. Lawrence told her the arson investigator said 5 to 10 gallons of gas was used in the fire and that whoever did it poured the top half of the stairs. Whoever did it knew Dad was there. Poured is slang for using an accelerant in an arson, Kemsky said. He added that the stairs were consumed in fire, so it couldn't be determined if accelerant was used there. Stephen Lawrence also told Kay Simpson a Molotov cocktail was used to start the fire in the home study. I do find it interesting how in the article they point out that the fire investigator says that the word poured is slang use for pouring accelerant in an arson. Now, Steve says that he found this information out from a fire investigator. So if he used the term poured, which is a slang term used for pouring accelerant, maybe he did get that term from a fire investigator. So how did Stephen know so much about the fire if Rick Kempsky, the arson investigator, hadn't told him about it? So, of course, I asked him.
Well, the only reason I knew or got any information is obviously we were right next door. The first volunteer that arrived on the scene, whatever, and then that night he was around quite a bit afterwards, and he took me through the scene. And as we were walking through the scene, he was showing here, and you know, that's how I knew what was what and what according to what he said. He had also been in our house prior to that and kind of did a survey of everything and what we should do and as far as alarms and things like that. And we also went because our boys were so far away, on his suggestion, we bought a chain ladder that would go on the window for them. And say his name was Dave Middleton.
So he'd come out to your house before this fire situation had happened just to advise you on your own home because of the other fires that were happening within the area?
Yes.
Okay. And then he was the one, he'd come out after your father's fire?
Yes.
Is this the time that you went through the property with Don as well, or did you go through with him by yourself first?
It was Dave and I alone when we went through. To the best of my recollection, the boys could have been there or something, but it was... Don was not there.
Okay.
Because I do remember showing him, Brother Don, later, the different things that Dave had showed me.
Yeah, because what Don obviously says in his testimony, he talks about how you and he and some fire guy went through the property, and he was like talking about how, well, Steve was actually doing most of the talking as we're going through and pointing things out as if he knew what had happened. So you knew because you'd already been shown.
Exactly.
Okay, but he made it out that you sort of seemed to know more about the fire than you should.
Yes, exactly.
What about this whole pouring of accelerant thing? Because that's another thing that is made a bit of a big deal about how much accelerant was used. Because you stated, oh, you know, there was X amount of gallons used, and then all these experts said there's no way of knowing how much accelerant would be used.
That is correct, but that came from Dave Middleton, too, on that same tour through the house. And if I remember correctly, I think he said 5 to 10.
After this discussion with Steve, I went back through the trial transcripts and found the testimony given by Dave Middleton. He would state that he was the first on scene and remained there for the next 14 hours. Once the fire had been put out, he, with a number of other investigators, including the fire investigator in charge, Mr. Kempsky, went through the property, looking for clues and information as to how the fire could have started and where. He is asked if anyone else was inside the property during the time they were going through it. And he says that on a couple of occasions, Steve would cross the tape to come and ask the investigators questions and for permission to do certain things. Mr. Middleton is then asked if the other investigators would discuss any of their findings at the scene, to which he replies, yes, they would on occasions stop and bring certain things to each other's attention. Were they speaking loudly, he's asked? A reasonable volume as to be able to have a conversation. Do you think Mr. Lawrence could have overheard these conversations? To which he replies, yes, I would say it's quite possible. He is then asked if he or anyone else, including Mr. Kempsky, the lead investigator, ever spoke about how much accelerant was used, to which he replies, no. He obviously denied on the stand that he said anything about, you know, the fire to yourself. He said he also denied that he said anything about the use of how many gallons of gasoline would be used and all the rest of it. So why do you think he would say that he never spoke to you about it when you're saying that he did?
Well, it wouldn't have fit the prosecution's narrative. plain and simple. It's exactly what happened, Jack, you know, and there's nothing more, you know, that's 100% truth.
So all throughout this story, there has definitely been some oddities and things that don't seem right. But Steve would drop another bombshell on me when he starts telling me about the judge that was presiding over his trial. This whole situation about your brother switching off the fire alarm and the burglar alarm, I find that odd that that wasn't more focused on, because that's got to be a huge red flag that, you know, he turns off the fire alarm and then all of a sudden there's a fire. Of course, there's such a thing as coincidences, but a lot of people don't believe in coincidences, and that's one hell of a coincidence.
No question. And the thing is, Jack, when, you know, he is wealthy in the community, they got the corporate offices right in there. The prosecutor, which ended up being the judge after he becomes the judge, which was Jim Fisher, that he paid $32,000 to sit and take notes and feed him information on a sequestered trial.
As a quick reminder, so we're not lost, we have spoken about this before, but because Don was a major witness in this trial, he was unable to sit in and watch the rest of it. So he pays a former prosecutor to sit in and take notes for him. Steve says this former prosecutor would soon become a judge.
And another, for instance, during my trial, stuff like that, the judges, my brother Don and his living, well, eventually it was his wife, lived-in girlfriend at that time, was going to lunch every day or close to every day with the judge's wife, and they've seen holding hands, walking out of the restaurant, heading back to the courthouse or whatever.
Wait, she was going to lunch with the judge's wife, the judge who was on during your trial?
Yes.
So they're
absolutely
obviously friends?
Yeah. And, of course, you know, it was all a thing about, you know, no matter what they had to do, they were going to take me down.
Well, was it proven that the judge had a relationship with Don, your brother, or...?
Oh, well, we all knew him really well. I knew him. I went to school with his daughter.
But then that's surely that he shouldn't be on your trial at all then, because that's a complete conflict of interest.
Absolutely not.
So the judge that is overseeing this trial was, according to Steve, known to his family. In fact, he says that the judge's wife and Don, Steve's brother's partner, were seen during recesses out having lunch together. And if that's not bad enough, Steve and I then discuss the jury in his case. How long did the jury take to deliberate on your situation?
I think roughly about a day and a half.
Yeah,
I
right.
I remember it's been a long time, but I think it was a day and a half.
And during that time, you're obviously just still sitting in jail while that's being deliberated?
No, I was sitting in a lockup in the courtroom in the back.
I mean, you know, stupid question, really, but what was the thoughts and feelings going through your mind at that stage? Because obviously your life is in the hand of 12 complete strangers.
Yeah, actually 11.
Now, with trials, you will generally have 14 jurors selected, 12 that will actually be the ones to decide on guilt or innocence, and 2 spare jurors that will sit and hear the entire trial in the event that any of the jurors are excused or cannot continue. They are able to then step in so the trial can continue without delay. Once the trial is over, 2 spare jurors on Steve's case are excused and would go home. However, at some stage, Steve says one of the 12 jurors is removed from the jury. He says because she was going to find him innocent, and this would cause a hung jury. However, the authorities would say it was due to some conflict of interest. So, bring back one of the other spare jurors. No. Steve is told they can't do that.
So now they got 12 seated, and then Brenda Carpenter, she was another one that absolutely was not going to find me guilty, and so they got rid of her.
Well, did they give reasons behind getting rid of these extra jurors, these 3 jurors? They actually say why they were doing it?
Well, the 2 of them, just because they only need 12.
Yeah.
And the last one, Brenda Carpenter, now, she had a conflict, stuff like that, but they could have forced her and stuff like that. But the thing is, when I wanted to bring back one of the other 2, they wouldn't do that. And even my attorney said, well, they can't do that. Well, they can do that, because I found case law and so much law on there that that's what they're supposed to do.
But that's the whole point of having extra jurors, so you can bring someone in. If someone like, you know, this carpenter lady disappears, they say, okay, well, we need 12 jurors. We'll bring back one of the two that are not here anymore because they've heard the whole trial, and we'll put them on.
Yeah.
On there, and then they can take the place of this other lady. So they said that we can't do that legally. So you were just left with 11 jurors.
Yes, and my attorney, David Dodge, you know, he allowed that. As a matter of fact, I remember distinctively that him saying something about if they bring them back, we're going to have a hung jury.
How did he know that they were going to vote that way?
Well, there's another good question, isn't there?
So we now have a panel of 11 jurors, with one being excused due to some conflict of interest. And as we already know, eventually, they return a guilty verdict. You know, in that courtroom, obviously, Candy, who had been with you that whole entire time, she was there. Your sons were there as well, I believe, in the gallery?
Yes.
And did you have any hope that, you know, you would be found not guilty? Were you still hopeful that the right decision, as you saw it, would come out?
You're sitting in there in a courtroom or any place, and you know the truth has been told and you're 100% innocent. Yes, I definitely did. You know, how can, you know, never been through anything with the legal process in my life, and here you are, even though you've gone through this hell, you think justice is going to be served, you know, and but it wasn't. And but the good thing is, and I think, like say, you spoke with Candy, is a lot more stuff came out in her trial that the judge wouldn't allow to come out in my trial.
Yeah, but I mean, you know,
which changed the whole thing.
That's obviously that is great that all this information came out. But for you, obviously, it didn't help at all. You know, obviously it helped with Candy, and Candy, you know, as we know, was acquitted of her charges. So essentially, as I've already spoken to Candy, you know, her attorney even said to her, like, I've got to do this trial again, like Steve is on trial for the very first time, you know, because that was the whole point of her trial was, you know, her attorney had to prove to the jury that you didn't do this, because if you did do it, then, you know, obviously Candy would have known about it. So his job was to prove that you didn't do it, and he obviously did that to that jury.
Yes, absolutely did.
As happy as I'm sure you were that your wife, you know, got that result and that your children weren't going to be without both parents, in some respects it still must have also been a gut punch.
No, it was wonderful. I mean, I thought when that happened, I think they got to let me go.
Yeah, right.
You know, but they don't.
No, well, that's the thing, isn't it? They hang on so much to this jury's decision, and they can, you know, it's like, well, the jury have decided. That is what they've decided. That's it. It doesn't matter that another jury have decided that you're innocent. They'll just say, well, no, all they've done is they've acquitted his wife and said that, you know, she's had nothing to do with this.
Yeah. You know, something that I imagine Candy remembers this too. I mean, within minutes, I don't know if it was 1 minute, 3 minutes, whatever, but after they said they found me guilty, and there was a small, like, fence gate, you know, in between where the people sit and where we were up by the judge's desk or whatever, and a reporter, a lady, and she was probably in her 30s or so, that was in there every day when they said guilty. And of course, Candy's crying, our kids are crying, and she came up and hugged me, a reporter. And that stuck with me all these years, thinking about, here's a guy that the jury just convicted of murder, and this lady's coming and hugging me. And that has meant a lot to me that, you know, she heard all the evidence, which there wasn't evidence. It was all bullcrap.
So after you're found guilty, obviously Candy has got her trial next. So, and I said to Candy, I've spoken to her, I said, obviously, if Steve's found guilty, surely for you it must have been like, well, I'm going to be next. Were you terrified that your wife would also be found guilty?
In Barry County, or I guess Michigan alone, yeah, anything like that. But the thing is, the best thing she did was get rid of the law firm that I had you know, went with a different law firm. And after meeting with him a couple times, no, I felt a hell of a lot better, because he, especially when he hired an investigator that had just retired from Michigan State Police by the name of John Boggs, and he was one of the top homicide detectives for the state police in Michigan. And that man was so infuriated with what they did with me. And he was digging and digging and digging. And he was the one that really exposed a lot of stuff. And I felt really good about it.
Did you ever enlist his services for yourself afterwards?
No. At that time, heck, we were out of money. David Dodge drained us.
And what did he say to you after the guilty verdict, your attorney Dodge?
Well, we're going to appeal this, which he did do. And the thing is, there's another mistake. I stayed with him all the way through the Supreme Court, and I should have gone elsewhere.
Yeah. But I suppose at that stage, it's sort of, you know, almost better the devil you know. You know, it's he knows the case, I suppose, and you're in that situation where you go to a new person, they've got to learn everything about the case, and that's more time, more money, you know. So it's such a sort of between a rock and a hard place situation, isn't it?
Yes, and if he hadn't basically bled us dry of money, because, I mean, his bill was in the hundreds of thousands, and he put a lien on our house, and, you know, Dodge, he just had, we couldn't go anyplace else, really.
So after your conviction, you never spoke to Don again?
No, never did.
Now, remember when Steve said that they knew how certain members of the jury would vote in this trial?
They removed one, and that was one of them, one of the three that were not going to find me guilty, and so they got rid of the first two that weren't going to find me guilty, and then they found out there was another one and got rid of her.
And Steve even says that his own attorney knew that if they brought back two of the dismissed jurors, they would have a hung jury.
And my attorney, David Dodge, he allowed that. As a matter of fact, I remember distinctively that him saying something about if they bring them back, we're going to have a hung jury.
How did he know that they were going to vote that way?
Well, there's another good question, isn't there?
How did they know? Well, it seems they may have had someone on the inside.
After the trial, we found out the next-door neighbor, Shumway, was feeding them information. He was on the jury. It was definitely cooked up.
Sorry, so there was a neighbor who was on the jury.
The judge's next door neighbor.
The judge's next door neighbor was on the jury.
Yes.
Again, I mean, that juror shouldn't be on the jury.
No, absolutely not.
That's just insane. That's absolutely insane, Steve. I mean, that, of everything in this case, I mean, there's so many oddities about it. You know, the fact that, I mean, the judge, as we know, shouldn't have been on, you know, even involved in this case because he knew your family. So straight away, we've got conflict of interest there. And then, you know, he also, his next door neighbor is on the jury. I mean, what is going on? I mean, that's just absolutely, as someone like me who doesn't know anything really about the law, I'm a layman completely. I think anyone would go, hold on a second, that person can't be on the trial if the judge knows them and they're their next-door neighbour.
Mm-hmm.
Did you sort of bring that up on some sort of appeal afterwards? Did you use that as an appeal to say, look, you know, what's going on? The judge not only knew my family, but even worse, one of the jury members was his next-door neighbour.
I definitely did bring that up, and along with the fact about the 12th juror, how they kicked it off and everything. And when I filed it, the judge, that was the circuit court judge at that point, disqualified himself because he was best friends with my brother Don and knew the family. So when he passed it on, it went to a judge by the name of Richard Shaw, who used to be my dad's personal attorney, and he denied everything.
So the first judge recuses himself because he knows your family, and then the second one really knew your family because, I mean, he was your father's attorney, but he doesn't accuse himself.
Yep.
He just denies everything.
Yes.
I mean, it's so incestuous. It's crazy.
Yep.
Don Lawrence has since passed away, but Jerry Mattioli, the private investigator that was hired by Don Lawrence, is very much alive and was spoken to by the Michigan Innocence Clinic about Steve's situation, and he remains adamant that Steve is guilty of this crime.
You have one
minute remaining.
This is the story of Steve Lawrence so far. As always, we will keep you up to date with Steve's situation and how it progresses. Stephen Lawrence's case gained quite a bit of media attention, but nothing to the scale and extent of our next case.
As he walked into court to learn his fate, DeAndre Lane appeared nervous, his attorney trying to prepare him for what the jury would say.
DeAndre was convicted of what could be considered one of the worst crimes, the murder of your own child. However, DeAndre's daughter was never found, and he maintains to this day, as does his daughter's mother, that she was kidnapped and taken from him. But he says, from day one, the police were not interested in looking for any kidnappers and immediately started to target him for her murder. And with no evidence against him, eventually they would bring in a cadaver dog. And this would be the evidence they need to arrest him, charge him, and eventually sentence him.
How do you find a defendant, DeAndre Lewis Lane, as to count one, homicide, felony murder, as to Bianca Lily Jones, or the lesser?
Guilty.
Next time on 1 Minute Remaining. 1 Minute Remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of ESA.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.